April 23rd. I'm in FPH, New Hampshire Colleges, series on science and human values. Evan Keller is today's speaker. She'll be presenting from her book, Genes, Neurons, and Individual Minds.
This series originated in a set of conversations that were by Charlie Taylor, who's the chairman of the board of trustees of the college. And the conversations included Alan Berman, the dean of faculty, myself, and a range of other faculty from four of Hampshire's five schools. They were really fascinating conversations, and they focused on the connections between cutting-edge scientific discovery and philosophical, religious, and social issues that are of broad interest. They ranged over many scientific disciplines and over many sorts of connections to the humanities. For example, we discussed the emerging neuroscience of consciousness, the possibility of conscious machines, and the impacts that an understanding of the physical basis of human awareness may have on our sense of what it means to be human. We discussed the human genome product, the possibility of human cloning, and a variety of connections between genetics and human values. We discussed death and the contrast between death as experienced by individuals and death as the linchpin of evolution. We talked about the ultimate cosmological fate of the universe and about the perspective into which cosmological theories cast human events. And that's an awful lot to talk about.
Yeah, what's left to talk about?
We didn't finish these conversations. But I have to say, we actually did touch on all of those issues, and with many different people in many different scientific and humanities disciplines. One thing that was really concrete that came out of the conversations was an agreement that these kinds of connections between wide range of scientific areas, many of which require really expertise to understand in depth, and many different areas in the humanities, these kinds of connections are rich, important, and underrepresented in undergraduate education. So these questions and these conversations led to the idea of this lecture series. Alan Hodder, the Dean of the School of Humanities, Arts, and Cultural Studies, and myself, with a lot of input from our colleagues across the college, brainstormed possible speakers who we thought could really address the core issue of these connections between human values and science that we had in mind. The result is the three lectures of which this is the first. Today's guest is Evelyn Fox Keller, and I'll say more by way of introduction in a moment. But I want to tell you that a week from today, on April 30th, we'll have Richard Lewontin, who will be presenting a lecture titled Mendelizing Human Differences and Darwinizing Human Nature. The following Monday, so these two are on Wednesdays, but the one after that is on a Monday, May 5th, we will have Hampshire alumnus Lee Smolin presenting Space, Time, and Democracy. All of these lectures will be here in this room at 4 o'clock. They're all followed by a reception in the lobby and by book signing. Today, we'll have Dr. Keller's most recent book available for purchase and signing at our reception. Also, I want to announce that tomorrow morning, the Institute for Science and Interdisciplinary Studies will be hosting a breakfast talk with Professor Keller West Lecture Hall in this building, with the title, Trying to Change Science, the Story of Feminism. And so you're all invited to that tomorrow morning as well, 8:30 a.m. Evelyn Fox Keller is Professor of History and Philosophy of Science in the Program of Science, Technology, and Society at MIT. She is the recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship and numerous honorary degrees, and the author or editor of over 10 books, the most recent being Making Sense of Life, Explaining Biological Development with Models, Metaphors, and Machines. And second and most recent, The Century of the Gene. The scope of her scholarship is breathtaking, including a PhD in theoretical physics at Harvard, pioneering work on feminism and science, and several major works on the history and philosophy of molecular biology. Professor Keller is also remarkable for the clarity with which she presents her scholarship to broad audiences. I know this firsthand, as I've personally gained a great deal from her work on microbiology, even though I have no formal training in that. Professor Keller's lecture today is called Getting Beyond Genes, Neurons, and Individual Minds. Please welcome Evelyn Foster.
For the invitation. It's always a pleasure to come to Hampshire, and I felt I came quite often, but I realized driving out here that it's been at least 15 years since the last time. How did that happen? I don't know. What I want to talk about today takes me into territory that for me is entirely new. But there's a way in which it can be said to follow logically from all my previous work on development and genetics. Also, it strikes so deeply resonant accord with work even before that in so many different areas that I sometimes think that I haven't moved at all, but I've just been addressing the same issues over and over and over again. So let me illustrate. So for example, many years ago, I developed an analysis of the inadequacies of atomic individualism in evolutionary theory. And more particularly, I called attention to the peculiar language of reproductive autonomy and how it constituted a mainstay of evolutionary theory. That is to say, talking about referring to offspring as belonging to individuals for sexually reproducing organisms like humans. When you talk about he had a son, right? I developed an argument that I tried to show, this was an answer to questions people asked me after I wrote Reflections on Gender and Science, about what language has to do with science, and I tried to show how language actually shapes our thinking, and in this case I tried to show how peculiarities of our language lead to contradictions, and I was able to establish some very major contradictions in that case. Before that, I had criticized psychological theories of development for a kindred error, that is, for the inappropriate use of individual autonomy and independence from others as a measure of psychological maturity. I argued that too sharply delineated a boundary between self and other represents not maturity, but a miscarriage of development, one that requires constant vigilance and control, and reflects not confidence in self, but ongoing anxiety about the loss of self. And long before that, working as a mathematical biologist, I offered a model of slime mold aggregation that depended not on any instructions issued by a centralized pacemaker cell, but instead that arose spontaneously from a population of more or less identical cells interacting with one another. So as you can see, variations on a theme. These are all questions about parts and wholes, and as such, it's the kind of question that has long plagued the social sciences. My point today is that now these very same questions are surfacing in biology as well, and all over biology. After a century of successful deployment of the methods of atomic reductionism, even the hardest of the biological sciences have now become obliged to face the limits of that success. Everywhere one finds indications of movement away from the reductionist strategies of the past and toward what we might call, for lack of a better term, a relational epistemology. So my first slide is a quote from Linus Pauling from a long time ago. And it could have been the title of my talk. But my actual title, Getting Beyond Genes, Neurons, and Individual Minds, refers to both the need and the difficulty scientists are currently facing in transcending traditional frameworks in genetics, neuroscience, and developmental psychology. Thanks to sophisticated new technologies, it has become possible to explore the dynamic interactions that not only bind parts into wholes, but equally that reveal the ways in which those very interactions constitute the parts themselves. As a consequence, more and more scientists have begun to challenge traditional priorities and to begin asking new kinds of questions. Geneticists no longer look for biological function either in particular genes or in the structure of DNA, but rather in the communication networks of which the DNA is part. DNA sequences remain a critical resource, both for the cell and for the researcher, but researchers now search for biological function in the cellular processes for growth and adaptation, and in the crosstalk between and among all the players of the cellular orchestra. So I read from an article on the front page of the Science Times that celebrated, an issue that celebrated the 50th anniversary of the double helix, and it writes, Natalie Angier writes, with all the breathless talk of human DNA as a grand epic written in 3 billion runes, the scientists complain that an essential point is forgotten. DNA on its own does nothing. It can't make eyes blue, livers bilious, or brains bulging. Furthermore, loose talk about genes for traits, whatever the traits are, is misguided not only because such language neglects the surely multigenic nature of nearly all characteristics worth studying, but because the phrase puts genes at the command post and ignores the ineluctably packaged interactive deal that is DNA and its setting at every stage of life. Some of us have been saying this for 20 years, but it's very nice to see it on the front page of the Science Times. Similarly, while the ideal of a fixed structure with distinctive properties, the neuron, may historically have served as the primary unit for neuroscience, today's neuroscientists are turning their attention to the dynamics of synapses and synaptic structures. Brain function, we learn, is to be found in the patterns of neuronal connection, forged in part, at least, by experience, and in the temporal dynamics of the signals that traverse those connections. Finally, more and more students of children's mental development are looking to the social dynamics that shape the emergence of the infant and the infant mind. Here, as in neuroscience and genetics, communication has become the new buzzword as traditionally reductionist biological scientists begin to discover the powers of sociology. One of the forms this trend takes is in the calls we hear for a new kind of science in biology, systems biology. What is systems biology? What, and relatedly, what do we mean by complexity? And how are we going to think about biological function in systems terms without falling back into the traps of biological atomism? So these are my questions, and I want to start with genetics, where the parts are at least conventionally taken to be genes, or more accurately, since the word gene is used in so many different ways, linear sequences of DNA nucleotides, and the whole is a cell of the organism. So, some quotes to indicate the current state of affairs. A new center at Harvard University issues a statement about the Bauer Center. The completion of the draft sequence of the human genome has marked a turning point of molecular biology and has stimulated a broad movement toward systems-wide approaches to biological complexity. The central question has shifted from who are the actors to what are the scripts? How does collective behavior emerge from the actions of individual actors? Or the lead article of a recent issue of The Scientist reads, for 50 years, biologists have focused on reducing life to its constituent parts, first focusing on the cell, then working their way down to the genome itself. However, such achievements created a new challenge, making sense of the huge amounts of data produced. As Dennis Noble puts it, it took Humpty Dumpty apart, but left the challenge of putting it back together again. Or, actually this is my favorite, the DOE, where the Human Genome Project was first born, a new project is now underway, and it's called Bringing Genomes to Life. Somewhere along the line, it was discovered that the genome wasn't alive, and I don't know exactly when that recognition hit, but it's hit now. And so they write, from the foundation of whole genome sequences, the aspiration of the new biology is to build a new, comprehensive, and profound understanding of complex living systems. The current paradigm in biology, variously described as single gene, reductionist, or linear, is not likely to be successful on its own. and more about the new systems approach. There's a lot of hype in all this, of course, and that's important too. Bruce Alberts, president of the National Academy of Sciences, argues that we need to understand how cells make decisions, and he calls this cell thinking, how they organize and reorganize their internal space. Or yet again, in the DOE report, they go on, we now have the parts list for these organisms. That's a refrain, we have the parts list. But it used to be, the meaning of that, we have the parts list, used to be, that's all we need. Now, the refrain, we have the parts list, is an invitation to, the next sentence is, but that we know it's not enough. Researchers are now trying to figure out what these parts do in relationship to each other. That is systems biology. And more explicitly, knowing the function of all genes in the genome by itself will not lead to understanding the processes of a living organism. Probably won't understand the meaning of the processes of function either. The skills of computational and physical scientists have never been in such demand in biology. But now they are needed to integrate and make functional sense of the data that's been coming from the recent triumphs of the subject. As Stephen Brenner says, sequencing the human genome represents a culmination of sorts of chemical reductionism, and now we need to move on. Yet even in these pleas for moving on, we can already detect the ways in which we find ourselves caught in the language we try to get beyond. For example, you know, these various quotes, what is an individual actor? What is a gene? What is the function of the gene? These are not questions that can readily be answered without simultaneously doing the whole systems analysis that is asked for. And of course, what is systems biology? The term goes back to von Bertalanffy, not a very reputable in the history of biology, who in the 1930s wrote with rather uncharacteristic modesty, the notion of a system may be seen as simply a more self-conscious and generic term for the dynamic interrelatedness of components. Today, however, systems biologists have more to work with and are accordingly less modest. They want, both literally and figuratively, to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Take, for example, Roy Hood, founder of the Systems Biology Institute in Seattle. Quote, unlike traditional biology that has examined single genes or proteins in isolation, systems biology simultaneously studies the complex interaction of many levels of biological information, genomic DNA, messenger RNA, functional proteins, informational pathways, informational networks, in order to understand how they work together. Or from engineers. Systems biology is a new field of biology that aims at systems level understanding of biological systems and to understand the biological system as system. It requires understanding a system's structures, the behaviors of the system, and as engineers, of course, understanding how to control the system and how to design the system. Last month, MIT hosted a major conference launching their new computational systems biology initiative. And I borrowed a few slides from Doug Laufenberger's introductory talk, so let me show them to you quickly. So, the opening of the talk. The parts list enough. And as evidence, we now know that it's claimed the human has about 30,000 genes. So does the mouse have about 30,000 genes. In fact, many of the genes are the same. So what makes a mouse, and a man a man? Well, obviously, it's from the integrative operation rather than the identities of the genes. That is, how they're wired together, how they work together, the regulatory dynamics, etc. And looking as we develop better and better analyses, especially better and better microscopic facilities, we can see, it's actually quite strong, extraordinary what we can now observe. We really know these protein molecules are little machines, we can analyze the physics of them. They're quite stunning. Or here's a typical regulatory network that is where all the data is expressed in terms of biomolecular circuits. And Doug was quick to point out the analogies between electronic and biological circuits. And in fact, we can push the analogy and we can break down the components and identify their parallels in engineering. So we are really talking, we can talk about biology in very traditional engineering terms. It's possible. And Laufenberger, this is a slide in which he tried to sketch out the different senses in which genes go into making up a system, so or molecules of any kind. So from one molecule, we go to the genomic complement, the human genome, the genome sequence. We can go to populations of cells. We can go to, the most important is the dimension into the board, namely the dimension of time, and looking at the dynamics of these interactions, a dimension that is sadly lacking from almost all genetic studies, but becomes conspicuously more important as we move up we move into neuroscience and developmental psychology. Here is President Vest. Vest is the president of MIT. Here's his announcement. time with the announcement of the institute and of the conference, and you can read it. The fact is that the search to understand our molecular machines and cell circuitry, how the parts are connected, how they operate, will initiate a revolution in life science. Until now, modern biology has been a reductionist science. That is, we have more and more about the detailed structure of molecular components of life, and now suddenly much of biology will become a system science. Vest and the others has great hopes for this, what it will do for increasing our control of biological systems, for prediction of biological behavior, for discovering new drugs, et cetera, et cetera. A new profession, biological engineering, is being created for this quest and for the medical advances that will follow. Well, this is familiar turf for us all, but it's nonetheless, the enthusiasm is familiar, but it's significant that the grounds of the enthusiasm are as different, as dramatically different today from what they were a mere 12 years ago. In neuroscience, systems biology inevitably has a somewhat different meaning, and most conspicuously for its inclusion of the temporal dimension from the word go. We know that the cell is a vastly complicated system, and as we also know, the brain is even more so, where there are said to be roughly 30 to 40,000 genes in the human genome. There are about 100 billion neuronal components in the brain with hundreds of trillions of interconnections and many thousand kilometers of axonal cable. Of necessity, therefore, neuroscientists face a different order of challenge. And not surprisingly, there are ways in which neuroscience might be said to have been ahead of genetics in its recognition both of the importance of connected networks and of temporal dynamics for a very long time. For example, if neurons are to be analogized to genes, as they often are, then the ways in which individual neurons are connected to one another has been recognized as of central importance virtually from the start. Early efforts to model the dynamics of such interconnected neural networks date back to the work of Reshevsky in the 30s and McCulloch and Pitts in the 40s, whereas parallel efforts in genetics, and I'm thinking of the work of Stu Kaufman and René Thomas, didn't begin for another 25 years and didn't catch on very much. And even, I have to say, even in neuroscience, these efforts did not get the attention they deserved until the 1980s and the rise of connectionism. Despite recognition of the importance of neural circuitry, the primary research emphasis remained on the properties of individual neurons. And here we come to the second sense in which neuroscience might be said to have been ahead of genetics, namely in its inclusion of at least some temporal dynamics. Indeed, it might be said that the first approximation, time takes the role of sequence in neuroscience. In other words, where the gene has historically been taken to be defined by its structure, and in contemporary terms we would say by its nucleotide sequence. Can I turn this off? There we go. The individual neuron was characterized from the beginning by its firing rate. The firing rates of individual neurons were thought to convey neural information in a sense analogous to that in which the nucleotide sequence is said to convey genetic information. And for many years, the aim of neuroscience was accordingly conceptualized in terms of finding the neural code, much as geneticists had succeeded in cracking the genetic code. As John McCrone writes, the textbook view has been that brain cells are simple logic gates, adding and subtracting input spikes until some threshold level of charge is breached, at which point they convulse to produce a spike of their own. The task for researchers was simply to discover how the output of each cell encoded a message. As usual, however, real life is rather more complicated. The simple logic gate has turned out to be a woefully impoverished model for the neuron, just as a hardwired computer, or in some views, the telephone network, has proven an inadequate model for the brain. Neuroscientists today find themselves obliged to acquire new sophistication about the temporal dynamics of neural populations, and accordingly, they are obliged to probe new levels of complexity. For example, it is not only the firing rate of an individual neuron that matters, but also the relative timing of individual spikes among an as yet incompletely specified population of other neurons. So too, information seems also to be conveyed in the oscillatory patterns and firing rates and the relations of these patterns among many different neurons or groups of neurons. The bottom line is that the neuron can no longer be thought of as a simple switch, but rather must be understood as a system in itself, one which is adaptable to the state of its surrounding context and tunable to past and current demands made upon it. To the extent that people still speak in terms of a neural code, they have begun to recognize that any meaningful code must be a relational code. Even worse for the idea of a solvable code are recent discoveries of the dependency of the output of individual neurons on higher order processes, on the expectations, thoughts, beliefs that an organism has formed from past experience. The brain may be a machine, but it is a machine driven not only by input, but simultaneously by its output. Conjointly processing bottom-up and top-down inputs to generate our actions and behavior. John Monzel writes, "We are coming to the end of one generation of effort. The next generation is going to have to look at the whole system and understand the effect that plans, decisions, and actions can have on what neurons do." And Chris Kalchin, Gil Florent at Caltech sum up the present situation as follows. Perhaps the most obvious thing to say about brain function from a complex systems perspective is that continued reductionism and atomization will probably not on its own lead to fundamental understanding. Each brain is a tremendously heterogeneous network. Understanding function of any of its parts requires a precise knowledge of its constituents, but also of the context in which this part operates. In short, systems biology. As in genetics, the impetus behind this move has come primarily from technical developments. From the wherewithal to simultaneously monitor the output from multiple neurons, from enormous improvements in techniques that visually monitor activation patterns, and perhaps from the sheer weight of accumulating evidence. this city, for example, is now seen everywhere in the activity dependence of cortical specialization and the growth of new neurons, and in both the strengthening of old synapses and the formation of new ones. Although evidence for such plasticity is far from new, the sheer quantity of the evidence that has now accumulated, at least some of it coming from new technologies, has been overwhelming and persuading even the most skeptical holdouts. Okay, developmental psychology, where the parts are individual minds or cells, and the wholes are the social group, society, culture. In other words, nature versus nurture. In neuroscience, it is assumed that the brain makes up the mind. And the question is how? I mean, I'm referring to the title of Walter Freeman's book, How the Brain Makes Up Its Mind. The question for neuroscientists is, how is cognition and emotion constructed out of the dynamic interactions among the components, taking into account all the ways in which collective properties of the whole in turn feedback onto these interactions? Walter Freeman is very much in the school of dynamic interactionism, but he stops at the edge of the brain, he stops at the skull. In developmental psychology, however, the question is rather different. Not how the brain makes up its mind, but does the brain make up its mind? Obvious to any developmental psychologist is the fact that just as neurons cannot develop in isolation, so too individual minds, perhaps especially individual human minds, cannot develop without the input of other minds. Indeed, it may well be that the degree to which we are embedded in culture is what most clearly distinguishes us from other animals. Not only are we social beings to our very core, but we are apparently so from our earliest days of life. Human infants engage with others through a variety of forms of imitation virtually from the moment of birth. Furthermore, without this engagement, normal cognitive and emotional development seems simply not to occur. Just why so much ink has been spilled over the question of whether human behavior is the product of biology or of culture, I cannot tell you, for it seems obvious to me that the answer is, as it has always been, both. This is what Merlin Donald means when he refers to the human mind as a hybrid product of biology and culture. It's a nice way to put it, but some might quibble over whether the distinction between biology and culture is in fact ever meaningful. To be sure, the human brain must have acquired the wherewithal that makes such extensive social congress possible. But that wherewithal is looking less and less like a language organ housed inside the human brain and depending on a social environment only for its requisite sustenance, and more like a far more rudimentary capacity for the kinds of social engagement out of which language evolves. Mimesis, for example. Here's Merlin Donald again. Our brains co-evolved with culture and are specifically adapted for living in culture. Cultural mind sharing is our unique trait, linked as it is to our conscious capacity. Human culture started with an archaic, purely non-linguistic adaptation, and we never had to evolve an innate brain device for language per se, or for many other of our unique talents. On the contrary, these capacities emerged as byproducts of our brain's evolving symbiosis with mind-sharing cultures. Language emerges only at the group level and is a cultural product distributed across many minds. Donald is not alone. Michael Tomasello, for example, argues that the crucial difference between humans and other primates is that for humans, cultural evolution is cumulative. And that it is so, he further argues, is a consequence of a relatively small difference in brain structure, but a difference with monumental consequences. What is physiologically new in the first instance is the capacity for the kinds of imitation that enable infants to identify with conspecifics. This is Tomasello's view. And he writes, this very small biological difference between humans and their closest primate relatives had and continues to have very great cognitive consequences. In addition to enabling humans to interact more flexibly and effectively with various kinds of entities and events in their environments, It also opens the way for the uniquely human form of cultural inheritance. Human cultural inheritance as a process rests on the twin pillars of sociogenesis, by means of which most cultural artifacts and practices are created, and cultural learning, by means of which these creations and the human intentions and perspectives that lie behind them are internalized by developing youngsters. Together, sociogenesis and cultural learning enable human beings to produce material and symbolic artifacts that build upon one another, and so accumulate modifications through historic time, so that human children's cognitive development takes place in the context of something resembling the entire cultural history of their social group. Perhaps the most crucial point is not simply the cumulative nature or the ratchet effect of cultural evolution, but precisely the power of cultural evolution to transform the course of what we normally think of as biological evolution. And here the mounting evidence from neuroscience for neural plasticity is crucial, for it provides a direct link between the internal workings of individual brains and the collective interaction of many brains. But to understand the intertwining of biology and culture in evolution, to understand, as Terry Deacon puts it, how the word became flesh, more than neural plasticity is required. We need to understand the ways in which culture molds the physiology of the human brain, not just in the course of an individual life, but also in population terms over evolutionary time. That is, we need to understand the ways in which collective cultural inventions are passed on from generation to generation, and therefore provide a sufficiently stable environmental context that alters the survival value of particular epigenetic and genetic mutations. Or to put it differently, the ways in which such inventions can shape the very forces of natural selection operating on biological variations. This new idea, its basic outline, was first described in 1896 by Baldwin, Lloyd Morgan, and Henry Osborne, but its importance has only recently begun to be widely appreciated. But I have to caution you, there is a distinction that Baldwin, these early precursors, did not make. This is a way in which to describe the effects of cultural evolution on the human brain is to suggest exactly that a form of this was a validation of Lamarckism by neo-Darwinian mechanisms. In principle, there's nothing wrong with that, but in practice, it's virtually impossible to imagine cultural effects being internalized, transmitted inside the brain. But what does clearly happen is that cultural effects, cultural conditions, cultural contexts evoke particular kinds of structures over the course of evolution that complement the external impetus or influence. They don't mimic it. So it's not that we eventually build language into the brain, but rather that the existence of language builds learning rates, increased memory size, etc., which makes the learning of language easier. I'm not going to pretend that the more traditional view of cognitive evolution as the product of individual selection has disappeared. That would be a bit like saying the gene is dead, and one need only look at the popularity of my colleague Steven Pinker to see how wrong such a claim could be. I'm only saying that an alternative, one that places intersubjectivity or interactivity at the core of both development and evolution, has become, after decades of disfavor, not only viable, but even compelling. For an increasing number of developmental psychologists, as well as neuroscientists and geneticists, all but inescapable. And the obvious question is why? Why now? What is it about today's biological science that makes possible, perhaps even mandates, such conceptual shifts? Or maybe it's not about coming from biology, maybe it's coming from cultural, social transformations. This is a
question one can ask about endlessly about historical events. One can even ask this, the same question about similar developments in the past. The answer, of course, is always going to be dependent on the particular context. So I ask about, I'm concerned, my question is about why it's happening now. I can't answer that question, but I want to, I will mention some factors that I think are important. And they are factors mostly coming from the sciences themselves. I start with genetics. Here, probably the most important factor is the realization of the Human Genome Initiative's first set of goals. As already evident from the quotes I read you, there's a widespread sense, first, that the reductionist phase of genetic research is now over, and second, that its completion is something of a disappointment. The human genome has been sequenced, but it has failed to tell us who we are. As the DOE puts it, we now have the parts list for these organisms, and we can see that knowing the parts is not enough. But the extraordinary achievements of molecular genetics over the last decades have given us more than a parts list. They've also given us the tools with which to go beyond the individual parts. And the more we learn about how the parts work together, about the extraordinarily complex and versatile systems of gene regulation, and about the variety of epigenetic mechanisms of inheritance at play, the more confusing the situation appears, and the more compelling the need to find new tools of analysis and new ways to talk. People also need the confidence that an alternative route is viable, is possible. And that confidence has been by the conjunction of computational tools with the techniques of molecular analysis, for example, gene expression profile, chips for gene expression profiles, and by the proximity of the entire discipline that has arisen in recent years for the analysis of complex data, computational biology. The situation in neuroscience and the reasons for its revolution is a bit less transparent. Here, too, we have, as I mentioned, we've profited from the development of new tools and new kinds of data. And from these tools has come evidence of new kinds of phenomena, or in some cases, new evidence mandating attention to older phenomena. In the first category, I put for new phenomena, neural synchrony, and in the second, neural plasticity. Neither of these phenomena can easily be fitted into the traditional frameworks. Whence come their giving rise to the incentive. But perhaps even more importantly, both provide provocative hints about more global perspectives on cognitive function. Also, the rise of connectionism and the powerful computers that make neural network modeling a practical industry provide its own theoretical fuel. And finally, because disciplines are opportunistic and they feed off each other, especially off of shifts in their more prestigious neighbors, I suspect that all the talk of systems biology and genetics provides neuroscientists with a sense of legitimacy. But while all of these factors are important, and probably others as well, none of them can be claimed as causal. The real point, I think, is the ways in which they reinforce each other until the collective momentum becomes sufficient to push a shift in perception. Take, for example, Sync, a recent book by Steve Strogatz. A beautiful book, a striking example of self-organization in time that has suddenly become such a hot subject in dynamical systems, neuroscience, and physiology. The particular observation of long-range neural synchrony is new. And in some cases, though not all, it depends on techniques, on new techniques. But observation of the basic phenomena of synchronization goes back at least to the 17th century. Christian Huygens, for example, 1665, observing his two best maritime clocks suspended from a beam 1 or 2 feet apart, saw that the two pendulums, through a kind of sympathy, he wrote, coordinated their swings to be in exact anti-synchrony. He described the effect as miraculous. Or, in the biological realm, 1680, Engelbert Kempfer working on studying Asian fireflies lighting up a tree as if kept in sync by an ethereal conductor. Huygens, in fact, figured out a way his clocks could do this, but his conjecture that synchrony was due to imperceptible movements carried by the beam was proven to be correct, or accepted as correct, only last year. Similarly, the mystery of the firefly has been solved only a few years before. Why now? New techniques of nonlinear analysis were surely important, but I think the actual history shows the possibility shows the possibility of computer simulation to have been more important. For it was seeing the phenomenon simulated on a computer that persuaded scientists that the phenomenon was both real and mechanistic, which I actually find stunning. In other words, seeing it in nature, seeing the fireflies do it, didn't quite convince them that it was real, and certainly didn't quite convince them that it was mechanistic. We always retain this lingering doubt about biology, but seeing it on the computer did. The situation in developmental psychology, I must confess, seems even more to resist a simple explanation. Here, while new recording technologies have certainly played a role, that role seems to me to be overshadowed by shifts in conceptual fashion that draw strength from outside the field of developmental psychology per se. Take, for example, imitation. So central a player in contemporary theories of the cultural origins of human cognition, as, by the way, it was also for Baldwin's accounts of human cognition a century ago, and consider the dramatic rise to prominence over the last decade in studies of imitation, both in humans and primates. A quick check of Medline PsycInfo shows an increase since the late 60s of almost tenfold in the number of publications and fivefold in the number of conferences. Once again, the topic is far from new. The various phenomena that go under the term imitation, social, biological, and with only a small stretch, even physical processes, have interested people since antiquity. One might even say that it is a curiosity of the 20th century that, until its recent revival, the subject has so completely fallen by the wayside. Perhaps the principal novelty today is its reemergence as a legitimate topic for scientific exploration, and with that new legitimacy, as a key concept in contemporary psychology and cognitive neuroscience. To be sure, new techniques in the video recording of behavior and in subsequent analysis have played a role. But more important, I think, is the recent discovery of mirror neurons in monkey, what are called mirror neurons in monkey brains, by Giacomo Rizzolatti and his colleagues at the University of Parma. These are neurons, they are quite amazing, that fire in response both to the monkey's own execution of a task, reaching for an object, and fires indiscriminately, the neuron doesn't care whether the monkey is doing it or whether the monkey is observing the trainer do it. Same neuron. Mirror neurons, the authors propose, constitute a natural bridge, on the one hand between perception and action, and on the other between self and other. As such, they suggest, and have been taken as providing, a shortcut between individual properties and social behavior of unimagined simplicity. Imitation can now be viewed in terms of a mechanism found in individual brains, underlying such diverse phenomena as the evolutionary leap separating humans from lower animals, cognitive development in children, the transmission and evolution of innovation and skill, the emergence of empathy or mutual sympathy, and the formation of social bonds. A miracle solution indeed, and one that on its face seems to contradict the basic premise of my entire talk. It suggests that there is, in fact, an answer to the question of which comes first, the parts of the whole, the individual or the collective, the chicken or the egg. The answer is first come mirror neurons, and these make social interactions possible. Excuse me. However, even if it were possible to root so diverse a range of phenomena in these amazing neurons, we are still left with the question of where do they come from? It's not impossible that such neurons such remarkable capacities could derive solely from interactions internal to the individual brain, that is, that they are hardwired, and that possibility hasn't been absolutely excluded, but nor has a much more readily understandable explanation that mirror neurons are themselves the consequences of neural plasticity. They are the products of associative learning. They themselves have been forged out of the monkey's social experience. These neurons are found only in the monkeys of adult, only in the brains of adult monkeys. They can't do the studies in infant monkeys. It may even be that the very fact that this question is unanswered, we can have it both ways, is conducive to the popularity of mirror neurons. For that makes it possible to invoke them in support of quite different perspectives on the evolution of social cognition. The plausibility of reading mirror neurons as originating in social experience depends in the first instance on the evidence for neural plasticity. But the implications of that reading for evolution, as I've already indicated, depends upon mechanisms for the intergenerational stabilization of the effects of individual experience through social inheritance. So some people refer to social inheritance as a form of epigenetic inheritance. And for the progressively internalized consequences of epigenetic selection, now known under the category of Baldwinian evolution. In other words, I'm suggesting that the move to the situating of apparently individual traits in social dynamics draws from many sources at once. From internal technical developments in psychological research, from new observations in neuroscience, and from the emergence of new perspectives in genetics. Furthermore, as we well know, the transformation of scientific disciplines is not just a bottom-up affair, reflecting experimental and technological developments internal both to the discipline itself and to those on which it reductively depends, but like cognition itself, it is also responsible to change above. That is, the changes in expectations and beliefs accruing from the general zeitgeist, imbibed from the buzz all around us about complexity, emergence, global effects, in internet design, in climate studies, in economics, market analysis, in short, everywhere. As Stephen Strogatz writes, what's different now is a feeling in the air. Even the most hard-boiled mainstream scientists are beginning to acknowledge that reductionism may not be powerful enough to solve all the great mysteries we're facing. It's also worth noting that such talk is almost always couched simultaneously in the dual claim for a more faithful representation and a more profitable one, and better understanding new forms of control and new principles of design. Even so, and here I come to some obstacles, none of all this talk about systems means that we have abandoned either the old dreams, I'm running out of time,
We started late.
Okay. Or the old terms. In fact, we seem to be in a transitional phase. Stuck in hybrid discourse, not quite a pidgin dialect, but more like talking in two languages at once, hopping back and forth, much as speakers of a new and still unfamiliar language tend to do. In the absence of clearly accessible alternatives, even the strongest advocates of the new alternatives are constrained by the language they try to escape. It may even be that the forging of a new language is more difficult and will take considerably longer than the forging of the technologies we need for measurement and analysis in the new systems biology. To close, I want to illustrate how the poverty of the terms we are forced to work with constrains us by showing how even the most ardent advocates of systems biology have trouble getting out from under the language they've inherited. And I'll do this by briefly looking at the particular quagmire posed by such old familiar dichotomies as nature versus nurture, or innate versus acquired, or learned. Everyone knows that we are what we are as a result of both nature and nurture. That we come into the world with certain equipment of a kind that enables us to learn as we go, that lends itself to remolding as we learn, and that in doing so alters the conditions of natural selection in ways that permit, over time, the restructuring of the very equipment with which we start. In other words, we are simultaneously hard and soft-wired, with each process transforming the other. In other words, there is no versus.
nor is there any possibility ever of disjunction. What rules the day is indissoluble conjunction. And many, many people would agree with that. Does that stop us from attempting to apportion relative weight to each? From asking, well, still, how much is nature and how much is nurture? Obviously not. It's as if we don't know how not to ask such questions, even when we can see them as meaningless. And once we ask them, we don't know how to proceed without resorting to the same tired old categorical divisions. The problem just keeps getting worse, for we keep trying to divide the pie, even while being unable to give stable meaning to the separate parts, whether it's nature or innate and acquired, without being able to say where one stops and the other starts. One of the most egregious fallacies, and I have to say, after a workshop I just came from, one of the most recalcitrant and also most common, virtually ubiquitous, is the conflation of nature with genes and nurture with environment. I can give lots of examples. I'm going to run through them. Let me just say what's wrong with that before I go on. It all hangs on what you mean by environment. In most usage, environment means what's external to the organism. So we have the whole middle range between the genes and the skin of the organism. What about that? Oh, biologists will say, oh, we can include that with the environment. Or in some of their measurements, they include it with the genes. The point is, it doesn't matter from a certain point of view. It doesn't matter if you think that everything in the organism, beyond the genes but beneath the skin, is irrelevant. You can tag it on to either genes or environment. It's just an empty term. So it works to erase that entire array of dynamics the importance of which we're becoming increasingly aware of. The same problem and the same tendency infuses virtually the entire literature on innateness. Like nature, so too the category of innate remains hopelessly elusive. Sometimes it serves as a spatial demarcator, as what's within. Sometimes a temporal one, as what are you born with. Sometimes as a species characteristic, as in, if it's universal for a species, it must be innate. Most authors use all three, moving easily from one to the other, tacitly assuming that genes provide a common denominator. What's inside, what one is born with, what is universal, all tend to be assimilated with genetic, while everything else is said to be acquired by learning, that is acquired from environmental influences. What's wrong with this? Well, obviously, what's inside is a lot more than genes. What you're born with is especially for humans, is the consequence, but for all higher organisms, is a consequence of an elaborate, extensive developmental process during which not only internal interactions, but interactions with the outside environment are crucial. And perhaps most elusive is the logical error in that if a trait is universal for a species, it must be innate. Fact is that any trait, be it cultural or biological, that is necessary for survival will become universal. Except the fact that it's universal just says it's necessary for survival. It says nothing about its being innate. Some examples from the authors who are attempting to lead us beyond genes, neurons, and individual minds. For example, Elizabeth Bates, for whom I have enormous respect, she's one of the strongest advocates of an interactionist view of development and a co-author of the book Rethinking Innateness, the authors lay out a new framework in which interactions occurring at all levels give rise to emergent forms of behaviors. As they say, it's interaction all the way down. But given how closely and heavily the dichotomy between innate and acquired or learned is dependent upon the nature-nurture dichotomy, even Bates formulates the constraints on emergent form as coming in only two forms, offered by genes and environment. Or here's another prominent advocate of dynamic interactionism in neurodevelopment. Joseph Ledoux, author of The Synaptic Self, argues that the self, the essence of who you are, patterns of interconnectivity between neurons in your brain, and that these patterns of interconnectivity are forged by experience, by learning. At the same time, he cautions, as important as learning is, not all aspects of the self are learned. Some are due to our genetic heritage. Indeed, he defines innateness as the genetic coding of an existing function. And in doing so, he has inserted precisely the opposite between biology and culture that his entire project aims to overcome. Forgetting both that the very meaning of function is relational, genes don't in fact code for functions, or rather can only be said to do so if all the other necessary apparatus and input is assumed to be already provided. Also, that learning itself presupposes the existence of an appropriate biological apparatus. For Ledoux, the opposition is construed as between genetic and learned, rather than genetic and environment. But it comes to the same thing. One final example, Peter Huttenlocher's new book on neuroplasticity, where neuroplasticity is from the start taken as evidence for the importance of nurture and as an argument against the hegemony of nature. It is nothing of the sort. It's just a mechanism for the interactions between our biological givens, equipment, and the experiences that we have. Okay. Some philosophers have begun to argue that concepts like nature and innateness are irretrievably confused, suggesting that perhaps we should try to do without them altogether. The question I leave you with is, can we? I think we can, or at least not without having developed some other ways of talking. And it's not just a matter of inventing some new words. That would be easy. Nor is it a matter of avoiding dichotomies altogether. That's both easy and unproductive. The problem, it seems to me, and I mean, I don't think we can avoid dichotomies. I certainly don't think we can do science without making distinctions. The problem, it seems to me, is our destabilized dichotomies by rank ordering their respective parts. Perhaps more mobile characterizations would help. Or perhaps we could learn to talk in verbs rather than nouns. I've been known to suggest that we think of the word gene as a verb. One way or another, I'm arguing that we need to forge new kinds of linguistic habits, habits that will enable us to avoid the traps posed by life, which came first, parts or whole, chickens or eggs, minds or societies, nature or nurture, and to ask altogether different kinds of questions. What kind of habits? What kind of questions? This I cannot tell you. My aim was merely to pose the challenge. Thank you.
I was told by my colleague not to ask you a question. I was afraid I was going to disagree with you.
That's all right, you're allowed.
You've gone ahead and given a talk where there's nothing in it I can disagree with. And that's unusual. I would be interested in your comments on the many meanings of the word reductionism. You've made an interesting case that systems neuroscience and neural network theory is not reductionist. On the other hand, there's a clear sense in which it represents a kind of triumph of reductionism. And there are people like Paul Churchland who explicitly think of it that way. And if we look back 30 years or so to the founders of artificial intelligence and cognitive science, they confidently anticipated that there would be a theory of the mind that was independent of wetware or theories of the way the brain worked. Alan Newell, Jerry Fodor.
Well, those are different kinds of
Zen and Volition. Exactly. Well, that's what I'm interested in.
Right.
Zen and Volition even chastised me once for putting a chapter on neuroscience into a cognitive science textbook.
Okay. It is true that that the word reductionism by itself came up many times, but they were all within quotes that I was reading. When I use the term, I always accompany it by the modifier atomic reductionism. So I was referring to the form of reductionism that seeks to build the whole out of the parts. Many people equate reductionism with mechanism. I do not. I do believe that biological systems are physical chemical systems. I believe that, I'm not a vitalist, I don't believe there's anything mysterious. I do believe that symbolic communication is of a different order and requires different modes of explanation, but I don't think there's anything non-physical involved. So, when I worked on slime mold development, slime mold aggregation years ago, I thought it was a great model for thinking about. In fact, it was appropriated to describe social systems, so how phenomena emerge from the ground up and studied by a leader. But some people said, but that's just another mechanism. And I said, well, yes. I wasn't trying to show that mechanism was not sufficient. I was trying to show that particular kinds of mechanisms were not sufficient. Reductionism in genetics, the word generally means, and is closer in this sense to atomic reductionism, it almost always means genetic reductionism, that you explain the properties of the organism in terms of the genes, the atoms of biology. Another, you're bringing up from artificial intelligence the question of logical reduction. I mean, that's a different kind altogether. I'm going to leave that.
I guess I have a question maybe brought on by you. I see a lot of this as actually the method of inquiry that I started with. I don't see it as particularly novel, or while it's unfortunate that I think a lot of us have gotten bogged down in it, actually I'm very sympathetic that it's due in a large part to the language we use in our modes of inquiry and our communication and talking about things. It seems that it is obvious that you have to account for both the parts and their interactions in order to describe the system, and the problem is how you relate, say, the levels of description when you're talking about the biophysical properties of the proteins and you're trying to talk about the interactions of the system at a higher level, say, at cellular processes, and then, again, we abstract up a level and we talk about systems of cells in organs and so on and so forth. There's been a variety of philosophers have their approach. The people have various approaches. I guess the question I would ask is there sort of a fundamental problem here, a fundamental rethinking that needs to be done, or are we just dealing with the fact that we are only now building up enough information to be able to start trying to put these pieces together in a way that allows that kind of systemic analysis?
I sort of fudged that question in trying to build, map out an umbrella. I'm not the only one who fudges it. I mean, it's fudged in the whole category of the term systems biology. In one sense, it is just what you described. You find out about the parts, enough about the parts, and you start putting them together. This was always the project. It hangs on the question of, there are two questions which become important. One is the question of, well, are there phenomena that are unique to the level of integration? And the answer is almost certainly yes. But more importantly, are there phenomena in genetics, like in neuroscience, where the system is constructed both from below and from above simultaneously, both top-down and bottom-up. And this, we don't have evidence for that in genetics yet, but there's very strong evidence for in neuroscience, and I'm putting my money on that being true in cellular biology as well. That is, that the effects of the systemic effects that come from building it up also then have to be
you're constrained by your environment. I guess to put in a...
it's more than that.
Well, to say, if we're looking at the simplest kind of possible organism in its earliest evolution, it obviously has to have arisen through interactions between basic chemical processes and the environment. That's all you have. You don't have individuation yet. You know, here we're thinking about something that has, maybe it's just made of protein or just made of something like that. That's the same process you're thinking about all the way up?
Right. Well, you're constrained by the effects of what you produce. You're constrained by the products of those interactions, and they feed back to transform the nature of the components. And that, I think that is what evolution does.
One more question, and then we're going to have a reception, maybe.
Okay.
We can continue this conversation. But Monique, do you have a comment?
Given your earlier work on gender concepts and modes of thinking in science, I was wondering whether you have done a gendered reading on this shift from atomism to systems type theory of the novel emergent language that goes with systems type theory.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to say that interactionism has always been very important in feminist theory. Always been. I mean, feminine. But why? I mean, that question, the affinity between feminists and interactionism has always been left a little bit unclear. I mean, there are psychological accounts for it. I don't think that the changes have come because of feminist arguments. I don't think it come because there are more women in science. I think this is convergent evolution.
But in linguistic terms, like the language of interaction or the language of dynamic systems or the language of systems and structure?
Well, systems is not a particularly... I mean, system is just a big catch-all term. Maybe feminists can help, feminist discourse, we can be helpful in helping us form these new habits of language. I don't know. But it's definitely, I would say it's a convergent revolution. Thank you.